goodness. Thank you for that very lovely introduction. And really, thank you very, very much to Ludovico and to Cyper for this opportunity to share the research that Maria Escobar-Lemon and I are doing on representation of women in presidential cabinets. And thank you to Angela for the excellent arrangements for making this all so easy. This is a real pleasure for me to get to present this research, and it's going to be the first time that either Maria or I have presented a bigger chunk of the book as opposed to something that we imagine would be one chapter. So that's kind of fun. It's really nice of Ludovico to have put together that introduction about women in the world today, in the economy, in politics, and I agree with everything that he said. The one correction I would make is that the statistic, which is correct, about 17% women in cabinets, that's going to look a little funny compared to some of the numbers that I show you because that typically includes vice ministers as well. And we're just looking at full cabinet rank ministers. So that number is a little bit inflated, but even with that somewhat inflated number, 17% either looks very good compared to the way things used to be or really pathetic, and we've got a lot of ground to cover. That said, I think the overall tenor of Maria's and my findings are really quite optimistic about women as the top, as the title says, not tokens anymore. We think it's timely to study women in presidential cabinets because women are becoming more numerous in cabinets. They're holding much more diverse posts in the cabinets in the Western Hemisphere. But what we're curious about is, do these new-looking ministers actually bring new and diverse types of experience to the cabinet? With the increasing appointment of women to positions of power comes the assumption that new viewpoints and experiences are going to be brought into the highest circles of power and decision-making. The problem is, as we see it, is that the assumption that these appointees are different is precisely that, an assumption. Are the women bringing knowledge of different interests to the top level of government, and do they have a capacity and an incentive to represent different interests? And so that's the underlying subject that we want to explore. Since presidents, unlike prime ministers, are not limited to members of parliament when they're selecting who's going to go in their cabinet, they should have a lot of latitude in who they choose. They want, or at least we hope they want, to select highly qualified individuals who will help to make their administration a success. They also have political debts they need to pay off. They have constituencies to whom they need or want to build bridges in order to implement their policies. So what we're asking is whether presidents employ the same standards of experience and qualifications when they're appointing men and women. But cabinets have long been a men's club, as clearly politics in general, since Ludovico set that up perfectly. So based on social control theory, we expect that presidents and political parties are only going to incorporate new groups into politics, in this case women, when they feel very strong pressure to do so. And secondly, social control theory would indicate that when women do get appointed to positions or positions of power, that they will be minimally different from the men, so as to minimize the change in the club. So based on that, we would expect that, yes, okay, it's an empirical fact that women are entering positions of power, but we would expect that they're not going to be terribly different from their male colleagues. Just to give you a very brief overview of what the book is not written yet. We've collected almost all of the data and analyzed it, but this is what we envision it will look like. Part one of the book is an analysis of minister backgrounds and credentials to determine in a systematic fashion if the women now found at the top of government are different from their male colleagues. And I'm going to present to you an overview of our findings with respect to backgrounds today. Then we move on to explore whether women are playing on a level playing field with the men. Yes, there are more women in government, but that in itself doesn't mean equal opportunity, equal access. So, for example, is gender a limiting factor in which posts a minister receives, or is that a matter of background? And I'm not presenting those results today, but our general finding is that gender is not the limiting factor, it's other credentials, but those other credentials do frequently track with gender. And then, secondly, does gender determine if a minister can successfully do their job, or is that related to other qualifications as well? And I'm going to present some of those results today. For those of you with good vision, this gives you an overview of our data set. The numbers, the big numbers that you can see, are actual numbers of women in our data set and men in our data set from each country. As I mentioned, we're looking at full cabinet rank ministers, both initial and replacement. That means 432 total ministers in our data set, 108 of them are women, so 25% women. Why these countries? Well, we include the U.S. in our study, even though both Maria and I are Latin Americanists, because it's the most extensively studied presidential system in the world. It would just be silly not to start with that big base of literature to draw upon. But we expand the breadth of our study of presidential cabinets to include Latin America because U.S. politics is unusual in a number of ways. The nature of political careers is unusual. The nature of executive legislative relations is unusual. And we want to address more generally how are women recruited into executive politics and presidential systems, and then what are they able to do once they get there. The Latin American cases are an important extension beyond the U.S. due to the diverse ways Latin American democracies work, and also, frankly, because Latin American countries, in many cases, have been far more successful than the U.S. in recruiting women into the top levels of politics. And so you can see the percentage of women in each of our countries there, and clearly Chile is well beyond the United States, and all of the Latin American countries have more women in the cabinets that we're looking at than the U.S. does. Why we chose these five countries to examine? We chose Costa Rica and Colombia not only because each of us has done field work in one of those countries, but because they're the two oldest democracies in the region. And so if it takes time for norms and expectations about what are the qualifications of a cabinet minister to develop, obviously there's been lots of time in those two countries. We chose Argentina and Chile because they are examples of third wave redemocratization, and obviously they're countries of interest because both have elected female presidents. Now, Costa Rica has recently elected female president, and we just had to stop collecting data at some point, so the Chinchilla cabinet is not part of this study. Qué lástima, but I'm not looking up any more bios of any more ministers at this point. We have to stop. These five cases combined provide theoretically interesting variants on government centralization or decentralization or federalism, which is going to affect the career paths of politicians. So we think they're interesting to compare that way. Also, these four Latin American countries are all countries with quite high levels of economic and human development, which we think is important for facilitating comparison with the U.S. We only look at the most recent presidential administrations in each country, frankly, due to data limitations. We need to have biographical information that's quite complete on every single member of a president's cabinet. And as we go further back in time, we can't get that thorough coverage. We miss ministers, and we think that's non-random who we can't get information about. So that's the reason for only having these most recent administrations. I have a handout for you because I have a more detailed table with our results about background that, as you see when you get the handout, you could not see on the screen. I have 20 copies of it, which I think may be almost exactly the right number. So what you're going to have on screen is sort of some bigger categories. There are a lot more subcategories on this table. These bigger categories are for the aggregated data for our entire data set, and what you have on your table is breakdowns by country as well. I want to note that all of our background information about the cabinet ministers is publicly known information about these people. And obviously that's what we're limited to when we're trying to get information about more than 400 people. But we actually think this is really a valid thing to be looking at, because our argument is that presidents are signaling to the people of their country, to business, to the international community about the credentials, the qualifications of their cabinet. And so if there's hidden information that the president has because they know somebody, that really doesn't count in terms of that public signaling game. So we feel pretty comfortable about the fact that this was information we were able to collect from publicly available sources. As I said, the handout gives you more detailed information about our findings. Here what we see is educational attainment. I start with that because that's generally the furthest back in time for most of the people in our data set. It's not the preferred slide to lead with, because this is the one category where we have had some ongoing problems with missing information. This slide shows that, in general, the vast, vast majority of cabinet ministers are very highly educated people. I suppose that really shouldn't be a surprising finding. There is a statistically significant difference between men and women in terms of holding a graduate degree. More men than women hold graduate degrees. But in general, we're going to emphasize here, because of the missing data, that overwhelmingly these are college-educated or beyond college-educated individuals. And as you can see from the table, there are differences across ministers, across countries, what topic people's education was in. But most of the time, the differences are not significant for gender, except for in the places that Ludovico already covered for me. And yes, that's there in our Latin American countries and in the U.S. as well. Moving on to work experience. We are interested in work experience in two different ways. One is, was your career primarily in the public or the private sector? If you bip back and forth between government and the private sector, as of course is the norm in Costa Rica with its election rules, we put you in that revolving door category up there. But then we're also interested in what was the primary occupation. So I know we have some sociologists in the room, some more specific categories of occupation. And overall, as this shows, there aren't many significant differences based on gender. Now, there are some significant differences for countries. What does stand out here, a little more than half of our data set comes from the government sector. Men and women virtually equally come from the government sector. So there's no significant gender difference there. Men are significantly more likely than women to come from a business background. Women are significantly more likely to be consultants. That's actually a major career category in Latin America. We don't have that in the U.S. And men are significantly more likely than women to have what's a combination of elected and appointed posts in their past. So it's that a mixture, but very much high office in government. In addition, we're interested in the group linkages ministers are known to have, because we assume that such connections should influence which sectors of society have access to policymaking and policy implementation. I'll be happy to go into more explanation, but just briefly, we define group association as any group with which the minister is known to be associated. So it can be a formal association, you're a member of the Chamber of Commerce, you're a past president of the Chamber of Agriculturalists, or it can be an association that comes from frequent, intense contact through your work. So if you're on the boards of directors of multiple companies, that's what we would code as an association with business. Or international, your work was regularly putting you in contact with the World Bank or the UNDP, for example. Again, we find very few significant differences by gender. Importantly, for the analysis that I'll be presenting in a few moments, there is no significant gender difference for ministry-client links. Ministers can have links to groups that are unrelated to their portfolio, or they can have links to groups that are related directly to their portfolio, or at least part of their portfolio. And so we think it's probably very good news that there's no gender difference there. Men are more likely to have links to business, as they were more likely to have had careers in business, more likely to have had a degree in business. This actually is probably going to matter for some of the sorts of posts that women aren't getting very often and men are getting. I want to point out at the very bottom, not too surprisingly, more women than men have links to women's groups. What we think is surprising is that almost none of the women in our data set have links to women's groups. It appears that at least in these five countries, if you want to go into the very top levels of executive branch politics, women's group links are a bad strategy. Not a particularly optimistic finding from the perspective of women's studies, but an empirical fact as far as we can tell for these five countries. The last category on which we were coding background characteristics is political experience. We're interested in political experience and political connections of ministers, since we think those traits may influence the type of post a person receives and also the success of that person in post. So we operationalize political experience and political connections in a number of ways. And as you'll see here, there are a number of stars. There are a number of categories on which there are significant gender differences. In three of those four categories, there are significantly fewer women than men. It's only political family, coming from a political family, where there's significantly more women. Women are significantly less likely than the men in our data set to have held a prior elected office before, not necessarily immediately before they entered the cabinet, but before. The office holder category is that combination of elected posts and high-level appointed posts. So again, women are significantly less likely to have been prior office holders. And probably of greatest interest, women are less likely than men to be what we are coding as political insiders. This is a term we get from Marianne Borelli's work on women in cabinets in the United States. Political insiders, our categorization is a little more liberal than hers. If you've been a cabinet minister before, if you've been a vice minister in the past, or if you've built a career in national government in the Capitol. So in the United States, the classic example would be a career in Congress. So not all people who've had a career in the public sector are political insiders. It's very much of a subset there. And women are significantly less represented in that group than men, and that's going to matter. So overall, with respect to background and credentials that people bring into the cabinet with them, what do we find? Are the women different from the men? And the overall answer is no. Education, we're a little bit cautious about that result, but if anything, we expect that women are going to get more equal if we could get a little more data. Work background, no, there aren't many differences. I haven't mentioned this yet, but one of the things we code for is, do ministers have education and or work background relevant to the policy area of their portfolio? There are no gender differences there. In fact, approximately 80% of the ministers in our data set have education and or work experience relevant to their post. In terms of connections to ministry clients, no gender differences. It's really only on political traits where we start seeing differences. So overall, we would say that the backgrounds of ministers indicate support for social control theory. Yes, there are more women in cabinets. Yes, they are in more diverse and important posts than ever before. But beyond that, they look almost exactly like their male colleagues. So what I want to move on to now is, does it matter? Doesn't matter in two senses. One, from the perspective of women in politics, okay, we've got a lot more women in prominent positions in government, but are they playing on a level playing field? Are they succeeding? Are they able to do their job? And then all of this information about minister backgrounds and credentials, we're curious if the experience, your CV, if you will, that you bring with you into the cabinet helps explain why some ministers are successful and others seem to crash and burn in a very publicly embarrassing fashion. And others crash and burn in a not-so-publicly embarrassing fashion, but they don't do anything to help their government either. So now that we see, yes, ministers differ in their background traits. No, most of those differences are not gendered. Do the background traits and experiences of ministers help explain their success in post? So obviously we have to decide what does success in post mean. Success is a matter of debate. It could mean the ability to represent groups in society. It could mean success at implementing the president's agenda. It could mean the capacity to manage the bureaucracy. But we're arguing in one of the book chapters that all these types of success require that a minister remain in post long enough to do something. And empirically, there's a lot of variation in how long ministers remain in their post, not only in our data set, but there have been numerous studies of Western European cabinets, and there's quite a lot of variance there. In our data set, duration varies from 1 month to two entire presidential terms. There's also variation in why ministers leave. And so what we're going to explore now is whether certain aspects of ministers' background and credentials before entering the cabinet account for this variance. Now, of course, we acknowledge that there are other factors that are going to affect how long a minister stays in post that are unrelated to their personal traits or experiences. For example, some ministries seem to just be harder to manage than others. Finance in Latin America is not a long-term career. Public works and transport also not so good. Lots of crashing and burning in that ministry. In addition, there are random shocks in the environment. A bridge collapses, or there turns out to be a tainted blood supply. Some politician's going to have to fall on their sword because this is very politically embarrassing. It's usually the cabinet minister that is going to have to step down, even though they personally probably were not at all responsible. And in addition, there are what we would call administration effects. Some administrations seem to have, they're the car with the wheels falling off almost from the beginning. They're just, the president's popularity is low, it's unsuccessful, and this is going to have a negative impact on everybody in their cabinet. Maybe you're unlucky enough to be president during very difficult times, and this is probably going to have a negative effect on everybody. And those are factors that have been studied with cabinet stability in Latin America and in Europe. And so we're moving beyond that to look at what the minister themselves brings to the table. So first, just a little bit of theory why we should care about duration beyond the fact that we can count it. So it's actually very measurable, which is nice. But, you know, other than the fact that some of them seem to hold on to the job for a long time, why should we care? Well, politicians care. If they are politicians, they want to appear successful. And if you get removed from your post, that implies somebody else could do a better job. So that's not the preferred outcome for most politicians. Secondly, time in post gives ministers experience that they need to make and implement policy. But we know that just because a minister stays in post for a long time doesn't mean they're necessarily doing a good job. It could be that it's just too costly to replace that particular individual. So the threat of removal from office also is a tool that the chief executive can use to control ministers, to combat policy drift. In addition, minister tenure affects the ability of the bureaucracy to do its job. And actually, there's been some interesting theoretical work by Huber and Lupia that argues it's not just that bureaucrats can be recalcitrant, and if the political appointees are always turning over, they can just drag their feet and avoid a policy they don't like. But they also have shown, at least in formal models, that if the bureaucrats like a policy, but they're worried that the political appointee in charge is going to get canned, that if they pursued the policy that political appointee wanted, they will then get punished when the new appointee comes in. So there are reasons in terms of the government getting its job done, why having people in post long enough to get a job done matters. So our research is new beyond this research that I mentioned up here for a couple of reasons. One is that we're the first to study presidential systems instead of parliamentary systems, and theoretically we would expect things to work differently because presidents serve a set term, they are not beholden to parliament to stay in office, they are not beholden to get a parliamentary approval from their cabinet. The U.S. is a partial exception, as we know, because of course the Senate has to approve individual ministers, but not the collective group. Also, ours is the first data set that has enough women in it that we can look for differences between men and women. And also, we look at more and different background credentials than any of the other research has examined. So what do we predict? Well, we begin with the expectation that well-qualified ministers will remain in office longer than those who are less qualified. So the question really is, what makes you qualified? What are the necessary qualifications to avoid scandal or disgrace? What are the characteristics associated with switching posts or with early retirement? So one thing we look at is it valuable to have years of academic or professional experience? And we're all academics, so we would think, yes, academic experience is very important. But one of my colleagues who actually used to work in OMB said, no, actually, it's not the policy expertise that matters. It's the knowing how to navigate politics that matters. You can hire experts. Oh, well, that's sad. So we're going to ignore him for the moment and say we expect policy expertise to matter. You will last longer, and you will be less likely to switch. But also, this is a high political game politicians in the cabinet are playing. And so we wonder, does extensive political experience help a minister to navigate the often turbulent political waters of coalition building to get legislation passed? Does knowing how to manage and make political deals facilitate a cabinet minister being able to do their job? So we expect that ministers with political expertise will last longer and will be more likely to avoid bad ends because they know how the politics works. We know that some ministers are personas de confianza of the president. In fact, that's probably why they were put into the cabinet. This may also explain why they moved from post to post. For example, in the Arias administration in Costa Rica, and I'm going to draw a blank on the man's name, but there was a close political friend, ally, supporter of his who moved around a lot. But every time there was a fire, he was the person who was put in to address that problem. So we expect that friends will last longer, but that they'll switch a lot. Links to clients we think will make you last longer and make you less likely to switch. The reason we think this is if you have links to ministry clients, you either personally know more about the topic or you're connected to people who know and care and they can be feeding you information that should make you better able to make policy and navigate coalition building. And in addition, it should make it more costly for the president to can you. Finally, one of our colleagues, George Edwards, who's an expert on the U.S. presidency, he said, well, cabinet ministers resign because they want to move into the private sector where they'll make more money. And so that led us to think that people who come into the cabinet directly from a business background, they may be more likely to leave. So we're expecting a shorter stay for them because, frankly, they're probably having to give up income to move into government. So we expect that they will stay less for a shorter amount of time, and that they will be more likely to retire. Obviously, we're asking how long do they stay in the cabinet, so this lends itself to a duration model. We measure duration in days in post. We use a Cox proportional hazard model because we make no assumptions about the shape of chance of exit. We're not making any fundamental assumptions that the longer you stay, the more likely you'll last, that there's an increase over time, decrease over time. So we use this particular form of modeling. We have shared frailty among members of a presidential administration because they are all in the same car together and will face the same problems of that particular time period in their country. And then lastly, we recognize that not all ministers exit for the same reason. Some switch post, others leave in disgrace, others opt to retire, some stay on till the end of the term or even into the next term. So since not all ministers exit for the same reason, we use a competing risks framework. To show you that there is quite a lot of variation in our data, and that not all portfolios are the same, we want to be able to compare across portfolios. So one of the things we had to do is, unfortunately, ministry names change over time. They get combined. They get separated. Everybody has a Ministry of Education, a Ministry of Foreign Affairs. That was easy. But mining, environment, energy, those particularly difficult. So what we did is we looked at current ministry web pages for all of the ministries to get information about their enabling legislation, what is their mission, what is their task. We looked at the organizational structure to see what all is included underneath the big rubric of that ministry. And then we consulted with a number of country experts for each of the countries to see if they agreed with the way we had consolidated ministries. And so that leads us to the 12 categories you see up here. You may notice some that are missing, for example, women's affairs. Because we're interested in being able to compare across countries, if a ministry doesn't occur in at least four of our five countries, we don't include it in the analysis that I'm going to present. So we ended up dropping culture, planning, and women's affairs because those are not full cabinet rank ministries in enough countries. Now, the only portfolio in which we have a significant gender difference is justice and security. Part of that is that there's so many ministers in that category, and there are a lot of women in that category. In general, what we see is within a portfolio category, there's a lot of range in how long ministers serve. So just looking at how long do they serve and gender, we don't see a significant gender difference. You're probably by now thinking this is sounding like a broken record. Lack of women's difference. In general, we think that's actually a good thing for equality. The average duration for men is 30 months. For women is 33 months. That's obviously not statistically significant. But for men and for women, the range is huge. For men, it ranges from 1.7 months to 121 months. For women, it ranges from 0.7 months to 97.4 months. So there are successful and there are failed women and successful and failed men. As I already mentioned, justice and security, there is a significant gender difference. There's seven female ministers of justice and security. They average 42 months. The men average 26 months. There are some important differences across portfolios. The average duration in foreign affairs is 41 months. The average duration in both agriculture and labor and social security is 29 months. But within all of them, there's a lot of range within a portfolio. But how long you last really may not be so interesting as how long you last until you exit in a certain way. Because if you retire on your own or you switch from post A to post B, that's entirely different from going out under a cloud or worse. So what this shows you is the four meta categories into which we divided exit. Survivors, switchers, bad end, and retire. A survivor survived till the end of the term. That can actually be relatively complex if a president serves another term or if you're reappointed by the next president, and I'll be happy to talk about that. Switchers are people who leave post, but they are not leaving the cabinet. They're moving to another post. In some cases, there are actually people who switch to a non-cabinet post. There was a woman minister of foreign affairs in Colombia who left from being foreign affairs minister to being Colombia's ambassador to the United States. We didn't really see this as a demotion. She was putting out a major fire at the time. So she's not retiring. She's just moving. Bad end. That's a combination of did you get fired or dismissed by the president or by Congress in the case of Chile? Did you resign in the face of problems or protests or surrounded by a scandal? Did you leave because of a policy failure or due to policy or personal conflict with the president? So that's why we're calling it a bad end. It was ugly in one of those kinds of ways. And then finally, retire is a heterogeneous category. These are people who leave to go back to business. A kind of general statement that people will make. Some of them, they're leaving to spend more time with their family. Some of them left to run for office, sometimes at the behest of the president, asking them to run. Some of them are leaving to help somebody else run for office, like to help somebody else run a presidential campaign. And others are leaving in a cabinet reshuffle, but we could find no evidence that their performance was the cause of the cabinet reshuffle. If you were the cause of the reshuffle, you'd be in the bad end category. But these are people, one rolls over, and, everybody rolls over and one falls out. It wasn't necessarily your fault. I want to note that we exclude from our analysis seven ministers who either died in office or became extremely ill.
That's not a bad end.
Yeah, personally. So that's four Colombians and three in the U.S. And we exclude them because these are people who were censored in a statistical sense. We don't know how long they would have lasted had this, they're in a plane that crashed or end-stage cancer. We also don't include the ministers in Cristina Fernandez's cabinet because it's not over yet and we don't know which ones of them are going to last till the end. So they're not in here. As you see, there's some variations across countries. In the U.S., 75% are survivors, but in Argentina, only 41% are survivors. In fact, the U.S. is significantly different in that category from all the other countries. If you look at leaving in disgrace, 28% of Argentine ministers left in disgrace. That's statistically significant from Chile and the U.S. In the U.S., there are only 3% switchers, 19% switchers in Argentina. Voluntary retirement ranges from 12 to 25%, but that's actually not a significant difference across our cases. So in sum, we think it's clear ministers exit in different ways. There are some differences across countries, but we think that the differences are not so great to prohibit us from comparing across countries, and we do control for administration effects statistically in our models.
Quick question.
Yes.
What years are they up to when?
Colombia, Costa Rica, and Chile are up to 2010 to the end of the Uribe, Arias, and Bachelet administrations. In Argentina, we end with Kirchner. And in the U.S., we end at the end of the Bush Jr. administration because we thought we were tying up data collection when Obama took office and we didn't want to take on a whole new presidency. And so we go back 2 to 3 presidents in every country. More in Argentina because De La Rúa and Duhalde served for such a short period of time. Okay, I'm just, in the interest of time, because you can't see that, let me skip over that one. So does type of exit differ by gender? Once again, the answer is no. So the outer ring is percentages of women exiting in each of the beta categories. Inner ring is men. And I think you can say hooray for equality. What we were most concerned about is that a lot of women are getting into the cabinet. It's imperative nowadays that the photo op of that initial cabinet look diverse. But so they're gone. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a couple months later, quietly shuffle them off into the distance. No, that is not happening. Women are not exiting any faster than men. They're not exiting in any different ways than men. I can also break this down into all of the subparts of the metacategories. I realize this is rather difficult to see. It still shows that there aren't significant gender differences, but I'd like to point out in particular, female and male ministers are similarly likely to leave due to policy failure or policy conflict with the president, 12% of women, 16% of men. And men and women are equally likely, or actually unlikely, to be fired, 1% of women and 2% of men. There are, however, differences across portfolios. So it's the green that I thought was particularly interesting. That's the meeting a bad end. The percentage of ministers who meet a bad end is much greater than 10% in public works and transport. That seems to be the bribery scandal ministry. Presidency, justice and security, housing and urban development, education, and then, of course, finance, because there's a large amount of turnover there. On the other hand, meeting a bad end is about 10% or less than 10% in culture, in labor and social security, in commerce and industry, and nobody in planning. You're right. Well, and we don't have that many people in planning, so maybe it's just that there aren't enough folks, because that doesn't appear in too many of our countries. Okay, now to turn to some multivariate analysis to see what impact we get from the credentials of ministers. So you have four models here. The column on the left is a pooled model, so where we treat all types of exit as the same, and then we estimate separate models for whether you switch posts, you meet a bad end, or you retire. Some things stand out in these models as similar across all types of exit. First, we want to start out with the robust non-significance of the gender variable. And I feel kind of silly being excited about non-significance. But even when controlling for all sorts of other factors, women are not more likely to exit in any of these fashions. And when I say more likely, I should mean more quickly than men. If you look at education or work experience related to the post, that's not significant in any of the models. Now, in this case, we think it's because 80% of our ministers do, in fact, have education or work experience related to their post, so that probably just doesn't statistically pull people apart. If you look at people appointed to the initial cabinet, they're in trouble. They are more likely compared to replacement ministers. They have a higher odds of exiting in disgrace, a 67% higher odds of exiting in disgrace, and an 87% higher odds of retiring. So basically, a lot of people who start with the president don't end with the president, and a goodly number of them meet a bad end. This seems to support Huber and Martinez Gallardo's research on Western Europe about adverse selection as a cause of minister replacement, that it is hard to choose the right people. Ministers of finance, they are at increased risk of all kinds of exit. A 211% increase of retirement relative to other ministries, a 217% increase in the probability of exiting in disgrace. Also, if you look at links to ministry clients, those help you a great deal. The client links, ministers who have links to clients of their ministry have a 53% decrease in the rate of switching ministries, a 40% decrease in the rate of leaving in disgrace, and a 40% decrease in the rate of retirement. So this is why we think it's good news that female ministers were as likely as their male colleagues to have client links, because that seems to be something that helps you to succeed, and women are clearly playing on a level playing field when it comes to that attribute. Now, we expected that being a politician would help you navigate political waters, and we actually don't find much support for that. Political insiders are significantly less likely than outsiders to switch posts, but they're not significantly less likely to meet a bad end. Apparently, political knowledge doesn't keep you from making big problems. Organizational partisans are people who have held a top post in their political party. That doesn't increase or decrease your likelihood of exit in any way. Experience holding an elected post is not significant. And we also find that business people are no more likely to exit. In fact, they're no more likely to retire early. So that impression from the U.S. case doesn't appear to translate to Latin America. And we think what's going on there is that the nature of career trajectories is different. And frankly, if you look across all cabinet posts, the nature of the connections you're making to business may not be the same. And we're pooling together all the portfolios. Because it's a little difficult to interpret the meaning of these coefficients in terms of what sort of an oomph do they have, I want to present a few graphs. This is just the baseline survival function for the pooled model in the lower, right down there, and then for the different means of exit. Now, the baseline survival function is where all covariates in the model are set to zero. So this is a somewhat unusual person who has none of the kinds of experience that I've been talking about. what we think is most important here is if you pool all the types of exit, there's a very steep rate of exit. If you look at individual modes of exit, the rate of decay is different. So we really think these different forms of exit matter. This will allow you to see how much, for example, in the upper left-hand corner, links to clients matters. If a minister has links to clients, there's a significantly lower probability of exiting in disgrace over an extended period of time. Ministers of finance, significantly higher probability of exiting disgrace. They exit fast. By 3 years into administration, 50% of them are gone. Presidential friends are not necessarily presidential friends. They are significantly more likely to exit in disgrace. And original appointees as well, as I already mentioned. If you look at retirement, again, ministers with client links are much less likely to retire. The line moves to the right. Ministers of finance, much more likely to retire. And so basically, that's a hard ministry to navigate. They either leave in disgust or they get ousted with popular disgust. Presidential friends, on the other hand, here they can be friends. If your president's friend doesn't screw up and exit in disgrace, they don't leave. They stick by their president. We also find that members of political families are significantly more likely to retire. We really don't have a good reason to explain why that is the case. So to draw this to a close, what can we conclude about duration and exit? No single package of characteristics seems to be determinant of how long ministers last or how they exit. Gender does not predict minister duration or exit, suggesting that women are not disadvantaged, that women are not being maltreated in the cabinet, that we have no evidence that indicates that they are being appointed just to provide gender balance at the beginning of the administration and then being shuffled off the stage. So we think that's good news. Ministers with links to clients of their ministry, that is consistently helpful to a minister. And apparently helps to keep you out of trouble. Our conjecture is that it helps to keep you out of trouble, and it makes it costly for the president to remove you. President's friends come in two types, the good and the bad. The good stick with the president, though they may switch around, and the other ones end up in scandals that are very high profile and embarrassing. And then finally, the cabinet post that is really the hardest to manage is finance. So despite how difficult the times can be when you happen to be in the cabinet, and that there are general trends for presidential administrations, the background of individual ministers can help predict if they last longer than their colleagues or leave more quickly, and how they leave. This is an important finding because ministerial continuity provides the cabinet and individual ministers with the experience needed to make and implement policy, to achieve the president's policy agenda, and simply to run the government. So we expect that politicians and bureaucrats might be interested to know these results. And finally, our overall conclusion at this point in the project about women is that women are not tokens anymore. Not only are they holding more posts in cabinets, more diverse posts in cabinets, but they are serving in the cabinet for as long as their male colleagues. They're not likely to be forced out earlier than their male colleagues. And also, though I don't present any of this analysis today, we're also looking at ministers' success in getting their legislation passed, and women are not less successful than their male colleagues, nor are they more successful than their male colleagues at getting legislation passed. So the overall positive note is that women appear to be playing on a level playing field as their numbers are increasing. The dark shadow on this positive finding, though, is that these women are not different from their male colleagues in many ways, so they are unlikely to be people who have the capacity and the incentive to represent different interests in government. Thank you.
We'll now take some questions. Manolo, Moira, let's take two, if you think. We take two or three and then answer them in batches.
Mine is very simple. Yours would be longer, maybe. if this is a rather optimistic conclusion that women are, you know, being treated much the same as men, then why are there so few? Because then what's the big difference there is the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
If
all those variables, then why so few? Why that? Because it seems like a contradiction to me.
Manolo?
Well, I think that this is not the dark shadow. I mean, it's the life, the real life, not the dark shadow. But anyway, Thank you very much, Michelle. I think it was a wonderful job, and I have really enjoyed your talk, and I will appreciate to read your book, and because there is a lot of ideas to combine with my own research. One brief question that is important for my research. Why do you consider the political family links as experience? This is a very important methodological point. And the other two larger comments deals with something which is very familiar to you, and it's a surprise to me that you really don't consider in your study. The first is the political party bias. Mm-hmm. I mean, those people, they are part of political parties, mm-hmm. and I guess that in a strong position into the political party will help to stay more time in the cabinet. Mm-hmm. What about also the discipline issue? And as you know, there are political parties in these countries that they are very disciplined, they have a very, very strong discipline, and they are highly ideological coherent. Mm-hmm. For example, I am thinking on the Socialist Party in Chile, for mm-hmm. example, those ministers that were from part of this political party are very different to those for the Justicialist Party mm-hmm. in Argentina, where ideology or the discipline is more flexible. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, also, what about the role of independent? Mm-hmm. I presume that there are some ministers that they are completely independent. They are very, very famous in the world of finance. They have been taken because their experience in this war or in the international affairs, etc. Mm-hmm. So the political party issue and mm-hmm. the militant issue. And the last question deals with the executive-legislative relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, first, in these four Latin American cases, there is one country, Chile, that they have a very strong coalition supporting all the time the government. Mm-hmm. While we have Costa Rica with no coalition and all the time pushing against the government mm-hmm. from the Congress. So that makes the cabinet weaker comparing Costa Rica with Chile. But I think that you could see that in the figures of the withdrawal of the cabinet from the point of view of crisis. Mm-hmm. And the same with Argentina and Colombia. Mm-hmm. Besides that, I think there are also two things that have to be considered, and also to explain the bad ends, mm-hmm. is the confidence question in, mm-hmm. in the sense of the normative regulation of Congress. There are some Congress that is mandatory to call the ministers to come to the Congress, and they have to be passed a question of confidence mm-hmm. with political results. And others, they don't have that. Mm-hmm. How could you measure this?
Right.
And there is one final question dealing with the periods of elections for Congress. That could be interesting for the case of Argentina, because they change Congress every 2 years,
right.
Half of the Congress every 2 years, and how can you measure this change? Because majorities change,
right.
As we have seen last year, mm-hmm. and perhaps again the confidence question also changed.
Mm-hmm.
So these are high questions to think about.
No, they're
okay,
important questions.
But it is wonderful your job. Thank you.
Anyone else? Mauro?
Maybe just thank you very much for the interesting presentation. parties which have moved forward with the book. I guess following up of what Manolo was saying is also, how do you consider the physical attention to differences in the political system, mm-hmm. the strength of the party system, what type of party system, political discipline in the parties. Mm-hmm. I would add other aspects which is related to what's the differences in the structure of the executive branch in terms of the number of ministries. In Brazil, every president creates as many new ministries mm-hmm. they want. I don't know, in these countries, there is no stability. Ministries split, ministries are... And then the number of ministries also collected. Maybe to, wouldn't it be possible to focus on the number of core ministries, ministries that mm-hmm. are essential, mm-hmm. and see if there you don't you find differences, like right. finances, mm-hmm. The foreign ministry, education, health, right? Maybe separating a number of core cabinet positions mm-hmm. would be more interesting to look at gender differences. Mm-hmm. And of course, as any other empirical study, there are questions of how you operationalize things. Right? I understood that you operationalize political experience in terms of policy experience in terms of education. And you mentioned PhD. So I think a member of parliament has been the president of the permanent committee on education for mm-hmm. 20 years mm-hmm. would be a much better expert mm-hmm. in education than a recent PhD. Right. So where does that expertise, how do you personalize that? And finally, you mentioned in terms of theory, where you both authors draw from, because in, you know, you mentioned social control theory, but of course there is a lot of theorizing about women politics coming from feminist theory, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And there the questions you know, shift a lot and used in the beginning the interest interchangeably the concepts of what types of interests women bring to the question, what perspectives they bring, and based on Iris Young and others, mm-hmm. the key question is what, you know, what do women bring to the table? Some feminist work has focused on women when they enter politics, they're in this paradoxical position because they expect to be feminine mm-hmm. and therefore polite, and they usually engage with feminine female issues like mm-hmm. health, social security. They're supposed to be better on that. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, they are pushed to be tough mm-hmm. and assertive and manly, right? So do you, in your research, do you deal with this line of inquiry that focuses more on feminist theory or not? Yeah. Those would be the questions.
I think that's a plateful.
Thank you for these excellent comments. And I'm happy to say a lot of these comments are things that we are working on in the bigger project. I want to save your question for last because, you know, given that women appear to be treated rather equally, why are there still so few of them? That's the big inequality, and I agree, and I'm afraid I'm going to end up giving a lame answer to that. It's the elephant in the corner. So let's come back to that and go to the easier questions. I can't believe I'm saying that. Why do we consider political family to be a measure of experience? Part of what led to that is Maria is a student of Colombian politics, and so she's in charge of the coding in Colombia. But we noticed that, you know, there are political families like the Barco family in Colombia, and there pretty much has to be a representative from that family. And why is it a girl? Well, if you actually look at the members of the family of that generation, she was the politically capable, she was the likely one to fill in, kind of like Muni Figueres in Costa Rica. There had to be a Figueres, but she was certainly a very capable politician. So in the sense of having grown up around politics, understanding how politics works because they've been in it all of their life, and because they get an opportunity, because when you're building coalitions within your party, you have to have so-and-so's faction and representing them through a member of their family.
Right.
So that's where that came from. So we wanted to be mindful of if you came from a political family. But we didn't consider that to be the same kind of experience as, like, you've held an elected post or you've held many appointed posts. And so we could remove that from the analysis if we didn't want to call that experience. The larger comments, the political party issues. Yes, we're very aware that these folks, most of them come from parties, not all of them. There are independents in the cabinets. The issue of does it matter if you are in a coalition cabinet or a single party cabinet, we unfortunately can't test very well given the nature of our data set. Chile is very much a coalition, but it's a coalition for the terms that we're looking at, Lagos and Bachelet. It's a coalition put together before the election and one that's held together very strongly. So there's not the issue of the president being constrained by the need to keep the coalition together. The other countries don't have the same, we just don't have a nice data set for studying coalitions. But this business of ministers who are independents versus politically experienced in a party, yes, they're not randomly distributed across the portfolios. And not too surprisingly, in finance and the other business-related portfolios, they come from a business background. And especially with ministers of finance, if you want to look at sort of a thumbnail sketch of the typical minister of finance, they typically are independents. And we're not entirely certain how to work that into the book. Regardless of the gender of the minister, if there is a political trait or an absence of a political trait that goes with the portfolio, the women look just like the men. Like, you're going to be an independent in this portfolio, and the women look the same. And so we're aware of that, but it's not showing up at this analysis of duration, and we've been questioned about that before, so we know it's something that we need to address. We do control for, are you a top-level person in your party with the organizational partisan variable. If you've held, you've been party president, party secretary general, jefe de bancada in the Congress, and we also include if you ran the presidential campaign. And what's interesting is that that variable is not significant in this analysis. So we do differentiate between sort of party backbenchers and party leaders, and we expected that to be significant, and it's not. And we feel pretty confident about that coding because that's generally publicly available information about people the politicians should be making known. In terms of executive-legislative relations, and this also gets to your point about what's experience that's relevant, a recently minted PhD might not know as much as somebody who's headed the Comisión de Educación for 20 years, we do account for that. When we're coding policy expertise, we do look at your education, we do look at where you worked. If you had been on a relevant committee in the Congress, that counts as experience. We don't have systematic measures of how long. We know if we have the information that you were a committee chair, we include that, but we don't necessarily know that we've captured all the committee chairs. So we're not parsing out all those details of experience, but we very much expect that if you've served on the relevant committee in Congress, particularly in the countries that are in our data set, that yes, that probably is more important than education from a long time ago. In terms of Congress having oversight over the cabinet, certainly in Chile, we have a couple of ministers in that bad end category who got kicked out by Congress. One poor woman, I think, got hit with a sanction that she can't hold a post for another 10 years. I think she was the one where the bridge collapsed. Yeah, I think she was a minister of transport. But it was clear that it was Congress who kicked her out. The business of is there a coalition in Congress that routinely supports the president versus not? That's a very interesting comparison, particularly of Chile and Costa Rica, because in the time period we're looking at, presidents have not had a majority in Costa Rica, and you've had this nice disciplined coalition in Chile. And we are looking at bill initiation by cabinet ministers, not in the U.S. because we can't do that, but in the Latin American cases. And one of the things we're controlling for in the models is what was the president's party's seat share in the Congress to accommodate the fact that some Congresses are going to be more difficult for a president. And also that's a way to take into account midterm elections in Argentina, just Argentina for the bill analysis. So we're aware of those problems and they're incorporated in the bill analysis.
And then you'd have to deal with legislative coalitions too. Right.
Right.
Because that would be, in Costa Rica, that would be the case.
Right.
At least under Arias.
Yeah, and we haven't analyzed the Costa Rica data. I was telling Ludovico earlier, we thought we had all the Costa Rica bill data and discovered we didn't. So I don't know if women are equally successful at initiating bills and passing bills in Costa Rica because we hadn't analyzed that yet. But obviously there is a component of executive-legislative relations there. And if I've missed one of your questions, Manolo, I apologize. Mauro, your comments about that countries differ in terms of the strength of the party system, the discipline, also in the structure of the executive branch, for example, the number of ministers, ministries combining, changing. Yes, we're painfully aware of that. We have tried to deal with the number of ministries changing and the combining and the uncombining by forcing them into a smaller number of categories, partly for statistical purposes, because we can't do analysis if we don't have enough people in a category. So we don't want 20 categories. We certainly don't want all the categories there actually are. That's, however, not really what you're getting at. Your point about can we look at core ministries is something that we're in the process of doing. Maria and I have been struggling about that for a number of years in our research agenda. We originally had divided Latin American cabinet posts into what we call blue chip, red chip, and white chip posts, and then we were told that means we're at Texas A&M where there are blue chip, red chip, and white chip journals. And so we changed it to high prestige, medium prestige, and low prestige. And probably, you know, some of the core ones are these high prestige, foreign affairs, finance. But then it gets pretty difficult. You know, in the U.S., the core, foreign affairs, defense, justice, finance, treasury. But, you know, well, Costa Rica, yeah, foreign affairs state. Oh. But in Costa Rica, well, obviously there is no minister of defense. Okay, so you just forget about that. But, you know, in the other countries, is defense really such a primo post as it is in the United States? It becomes a little more difficult. And then there are also those middle kinds of ministries that are not high prestige like foreign affairs, but education, health. They control an enormous budget. They deliver an enormous amount of services. Women hold those posts. That's where you find the most women. And so they matter. So we are looking at how your background traits correlate with getting different kinds of posts. We've divided them into these different prestige areas. There are also feminine policy domains, masculine policy domains, which don't completely overlap with high and medium and low prestige. So we're looking at that. And the one chapter that we haven't collected the data for yet that we're interested in is, do presidents appoint women to the posts that are of key importance during their administration? And right now, what we are starting to collect the data for is, in public opinion surveys, what do people list as the key problems facing the country now? And so if you use that to operationalize core ministries, are women getting those posts? And then to look for gender differences in terms of, do women get those posts, the characteristics of people who get those posts? So we're very aware of your comment, and we think it's an extremely important one. You'll have to wait till the book comes out to see what we find, because we're still really grappling with how you measure core posts cross-nationally. Oh, and then lastly, with bringing in feminist theory, and also the more general idea that women are forced to behave in a feminine fashion, but then they're also expected to be tough. We have no measures of how they actually behave, but it would be really cool if we could get grant money to observe cabinets. I don't think they'd let us in. But we are interested in the bills that ministers initiate. Is the increased incidence of women leading to more legislation on what would be called women's issues, our children's and families' issues, which gets you into the terribly dangerous territory of what's a women's issue? I've been coding all of the legislation that we've pulled together, and there, especially if you take a rather limited, you know, very, you know, violence against women, that would probably be uniformly considered to be a women's issue. There really isn't that much legislation, and I can't yet tell you if the female ministers are initiating more of those bills, because we haven't done that analysis. But we are. That's how we're going to try to get at what are they doing without actually observing the dynamics of the behavior in the cabinets, because we just have no way of measuring that.
What about the elephant in the room?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Michelle Bachelet had 50% women in her cabinet initially. In fact, a little, tiny bit over 50%. It went badly. From what I've been told by friends who are scholars of Chilean politics, it wasn't because there were women. It was because she did two things at the same time. She wanted gender parity, and she wanted what she called no second helpings, no people who'd held cabinet posts before. So she had this horrible selection problem because she had to balance the coalition to keep the coalition happy. She wanted all new people, and she wanted gender balance, and she ended up having to shuffle her cabinet multiple times in the first year. And ultimately there were less than 50% women. And so it's hard to say that that great increase in the percentage of women was the problem. It may have been these other dimensions on which she was already also trying to maximize. But it didn't help her presidency because she had lots of shufflings that made her look less successful as a manager. Cristina Fernandez did nothing like that. She basically took Nestor's cabinet and put it in her as her cabinet, so there was almost no change. It would be fun to bring in Laura Chinchilla's cabinet because she hasn't just lifted Arias's ministers and put them into her cabinet. She also made no gender statements that I'm aware of about wanting anything. She was not following in Michelle Bachelet's footsteps. So we don't really have any arguments for why the percentage of women hasn't reached parity, except where in Michelle Bachelet's cabinet where she said she was going to do that, and she did. What we think is something that's more tractable is when are women getting posts that they haven't gotten before. We have lots of women ministers, female ministers of defense, female ministers of state across all of our countries. The one serious glass ceiling seems to be finance or treasury. We have one female minister of finance in Argentina. She went down in flames, but that's probably nothing to do with gender. But there, that seems to be the real glass ceiling. And what it appears in our research is that it's not because they're women. It's because there's this package of traits, especially being an independent with impressive credentials in the business world. And women are less likely to come from business careers. They're less likely to have a business degree. They're less likely to have connections to business associations. So it's possible that it's not the gender that's still keeping women out of some posts, but that women are less likely to have this package of credentials, which presumably will change as all the things that Ludovico was saying at the beginning, you know, women are exceeding men in education and maybe acquiring that set of credentials. But only time will tell on that, because I think that seems to be more the really difficult barrier, more than the number of women.
We have a couple more minutes. Tom?
Are there any differences in actual age? I'm just thinking generational. Are women appointed at a younger?
Oh, good question. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and we haven't checked that because we don't have ages for everybody, and I'm guessing we're missing ages more for women than for men because it's not polite to ask. But we have, every time we see a birth date or an age at appointment, we've collected that. I don't perceive that the women are younger. In fact, I would wager that they're older. And the reason I say that is that women in the legislature are usually older. And the argument that's generally put forward is that they're busy having kids when they would normally be starting their career, and just the rigors of the campaign trail are incompatible with raising young children. So they frequently enter politics later, or they get slammed because they didn't get married, they didn't have kids, they don't fit the stereotypical family person, and so they enter at the same age as men, but then they don't look right. So I'm guessing that if there is a difference, it's that the women are a little bit older. But what I can tell you is that the majority of them are right at my age, the men and the women, because it's really frustrating. They have these incredible CVs, and they have families, and they've raised lots of kids. And I'm like, oh, well, I feel like a failure. In general, in the Latin American cases, they're about my age for both the men and the women.
If you could, what countries would you do next?
Brazil. Because it's big and important and we get asked about it all the time.
Right. I want to know what your opinion is since the new president.
Well, and, yes, of course, with that. And the reason we did, for one, it's just the amount of time it takes to collect the bios on everybody. And the data gets old. So we're not adding any more countries and we're not adding more presidencies. But Brazil, I think, would be very, very interesting. And neither Maria or I are Portuguese speakers, so the amount of time it would take to collect the data would be exponentially more difficult. We could overcome that with the assistance of graduate students. But I think that would be a really interesting addition.
Any final questions? David?
That prompts me to ask just why not Mexico, too, of course. and this might be a really boring question for many people, but I do survival analysis, so it's interesting to me. Why Cox? I understand that there's that the idea of cops gives you a lot of leeway in terms of you're not forcing a shape into mm-hmm. the risk and the proportionality, but you are holding all the risks at a proportional level to each other. And that, I think, for theoretical reasons, seems to point exactly to what Manolo is talking mm-hmm. about, right? Different political parties, quota systems in some political parties, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, specifically thinking in Mexico, where the PRD actually has a quota system to include more women, and in Chile, something similar happens, in Costa Rica. So, mm-hmm. so trying not to hold a proportionality, in other words, trying not to fit that the same proportionality is valid for all the cases, would seem to me a little better of a model. That's but for theoretical reasons, but. Then the other question, and of course, for all of us that do survival analysis, it's a series of painful decisions that we have to make at every step. So I understand that probably it was a painful decision to make at some point. And the other question that also had to do with methodology is, in terms of unobserved heterogeneity, it seems. So you have a lot of repeated cases, right? Mm-hmm. And a universe that's, you're taking countries, you're taking cabinets within countries. So you have a lot of failures, mm-hmm. Repeated failures. And shared frailty by administration, which is what you're mm-hmm. trying to yes. do, right? So it's a great idea of trying to think of, okay, within each administration, there'll be certain, at least realistic constraints in which maybe an administration is more likely to boot people out, mm-hmm. right? So that makes a lot of sense. But the other thing is, which is why I think maybe a non-proportional mm-hmm. model would work better, is that it would also account for other types of unobserved heterogeneity. In other cases, other things that you're not thinking that might be causing repeated mm-hmm. failures to mm-hmm. happen. Maybe not administrations only, but midterm switching of cabinets. Mm-hmm. Who's in power during Congress? Which party is in power during Congress at that time? So I wanted to know if what was that decision process like, or why was Cox chosen in this case?
I wish Maria were here to help me with answering that question. Yes, a lot of hard decisions were made, and they're not perfect. We still haven't done the robustness checks about the proportionality assumptions. I have... printed out an email from her here where I was asking some of these kinds of questions a couple of days ago, and she says she's not particularly worried about those proportionality assumptions blowing up, but it still has to be done. And the reason it hasn't been done yet is we want the data set to stop wiggling. We want, you know, this is the model we want to stick with and then go through and do this. But we are aware that those are questions that need to be verified. The idea of a non-proportional model, I will bring that home to her so we can discuss it, because clearly there are problems in some administrations, and other administrations are relatively tranquil. But that doesn't account for the fact that the U.S. and Argentina have midterm elections, that Chile has coalitions that work, that Colombia, who can tell what party people are from, that Costa Rica used to have a much more stable party system, and now presidents are having to learn how to build coalitions. You know, those kinds of differences. We don't want to just throw in country dummies, but we are aware that those country differences exist, and so I will discuss that with her. That's something that we can change. We can't add Mexico because we're just not adding more countries. Because if we spent a couple of months adding another country, then meanwhile, you know, so, well, why didn't you include the Chinchilla administration? It's almost done by now, you know, and that we're worried about the Obama administration and getting comments, why didn't you include that one? It's interesting. No more administrations. So that we just say no, but the decision of how best to model duration to take into some account these things that affect the whole cabinet is important.
Well, let me just finish by thanking you. And by also, I neglected to mention at the beginning that this talk was co-sponsored by the Newcomb College Institute, and we're very grateful for that. I believe you join us from there, right?
Yes.
Thank you so much. And thank you to Michelle.
Well, thank you all very much for this great conference.